I'm here at the Accra Guest House with Rachel Horlings, and I've been interviewing missionaries for the blog, and she kind of qualifies as a missionary because she was a missionary kid, but she is out here as a marine archaeologist, and she's working off the coast of Ghana, and I thought that would be a really interesting person to interview and add some variety to the mix here. So I'm going to ask Rachel to talk about growing up in West Africa and then how she got into marine archaeology. So tell us where you're from and all that, Rachel.
I was born in Benue State, Nigeria. My parents have now been missionaries there for almost 31 years. They still live there. I went to Hillcrest School through my senior year, and then I went to the U.S. for school. I did most of my bachelor's and my master's at Florida State, and I'm now at Syracuse University in New York working on my PhD. I'm in Ghana working on my dissertation research. I do maritime historical archaeology. My focus is on people's interactions and use with the sea across international borders. So I'm looking at historic trade in Ghana from the perspective of the sea looking onto land. So I work mostly with shipwrecks. And I've been here in Ghana working on a number of different things, but primarily on one shipwreck off of the coast of Elmina. We've been doing excavation, we've been doing a bunch of different stuff. The project just ended now, actually, and I am working on processing data. I'm trying to sort out what the heck we've been doing for the past 6 months.
Can you tell me about the actual process of going down and looking at this shipwreck and recovering things and then what you do with that stuff?
The project that we're working on, actually, there are three of us who have been working on it, and we're the only three people working on this in West Africa, actually, from an academic perspective. They're treasure hunters, but they really don't count as horrid people. A friend of mine who actually started this project was a grad student at Syracuse University, and he came out and did a bunch of remote sensing in the area, side scan sonar, and from that, essentially, you get a picture of the seafloor, and you analyze that to find different targets to look at. The third target he dove on happened to be this shipwreck. And I've done actually an extensive analysis of this data since then, and we found a bunch more other targets. But right now, none of them ended up being shipwrecks, which is very, very curious. Elmina was the longest occupied, it was the first European fort built in West Africa. It was the longest occupied fort in this area. And there's a lot of heavy traffic here. It's very strange that, to me, it's almost impossible that there's only one shipwreck after 500 years of traffic in this area. So it's actually really intriguing. So actually working on this shipwreck was sort of a backup for both my other colleague and I this summer. And what we ended up doing is that this is a very, very unique environment, a marine environment, because it's incredibly high energy. And for much of the year, you literally can't see your hand in front of your eyes on this site. So we ended up, in 2005, they mapped this shipwreck as accurately as they could. And part of what we did this time was going back and rechecking that. And then we also worked on actually excavating part of this shipwreck. And I work a little bit more on the science side, so I've done a lot of taking sediment cores and that sort of thing to analyze site formation processes of what's going on the shipwreck so that we can understand this one and hopefully to build a predictive model looking at shipwrecks across Ghana and eventually I'd like to go back and work in Nigeria. I think the funniest part to talk about here is for over 2 months when we were working, you honestly literally couldn't see anything, and I would just start laughing sometimes because I wouldn't know if my eyes were open or shut. And it's not very funny, but what it really is a testament to God's protection and grace, because you would go down and not have a clue where you were, not be able to see anything, and it would just be... It was the most amazing thing to know, you know, God can see me down here. Like, I don't have a clue what I'm running into, what I'm grabbing, what's about to grab me. And yet God does. And I think that's, besides all the academic data I've taken from it, that's something that has just been so, so, so real on this project, is just that God knows us everywhere. He can reach us everywhere. And what an amazing thing that is.
Tell us about the shipwreck that you are looking at. What you found out about that one and about that boat?
That's actually pretty easy. We don't know very much. We know that it was most likely an inbound merchantman. probably Dutch, although there's some markers indicating that it may be from another place. A lot of people think of history as being very cut and dry, and most of that's because most of history is written by the victor, by the winner, and you don't learn about the common people or the daily things that go on, and that's actually something that's really intriguing about maritime archaeology and being able to study the people who were on the vessel. Sailors were generally low-class people who were just shoved on a boat. So one of the things actually my colleague is looking at is nationality. How do you tell where this vessel was from? Is nationality the country it was built in? Is nationality the captain? Is nationality the flag it carried? Is nationality the last port it was at? Is nationality the goods it was carrying? How do you even begin to look at that? So this vessel that we have has a bunch of just nondescript goods on it that we're not going to be able to say, unless possibly we can source the metals from things or something. But that doesn't mean anything either, because there was so much trade going on. That's actually also the same issue with dating something. We've got a date range on this vessel from 17th through the early 19th century. It's probably an early 19th century, which means it's very likely not a slave vessel because it was sailing post-legal slave trade, but that also doesn't mean anything because the number of slaves sold actually increased after the abolition of slave trade. It didn't decrease for a while. So I can say this is most likely a Dutch vessel, and that would make sense because Elmina was still owned by the Dutch at this time. Where it wrecked, it was a very common anchorage area. It's very possible that it wrecked at anchor, although that's something that I'm looking at, trying to figure out is possible wrecking causes, why there's no rocks, there's nothing where it is. There's nothing that says, oh, this is what wrecked this vessel, which is part of the story, not only of the people who were on the shipwreck, but of what they were doing here. And that's something that you've got to keep in mind, too. People think of archaeology or of underwater archaeology as, oh, you're looking for gold on a shipwreck. And we're not. I hate gold. And we're looking to study the people, both the Europeans on the vessel and how they interacted with the people on the coast. West Africa was a phenomenally difficult place to trade with, not only because of cultural differences and that sort of thing, but pure logistics. Because this is such a high energy and rough coast, vessels actually ended up anchoring mile and a half offshore, and they used local canoes to ferry goods back and forth. Elmina was famous all along the coast of West Africa for its canoemen. So all of that comes into the picture of what was going on with these people. If you read historical accounts, captains will say, oh, we stopped at Elmina and traded such and such and then moved on, or whatever, and you never really learn about the interactions of what's going on, you know? What did the things that this vessel was carrying, what does that mean in terms of what was being traded, and what does that mean in terms of what the people who were being traded with wanted and what the Europeans were getting in return, and how do you begin to assess that and look at that? So it's been a bit of a tangent, but really what it comes down to is studying this, is learning how to ask questions and learning how to learn about people from the past when they're not there to tell you. But maritime archaeology is actually very, very unique in that things are often preserved on shipwrecks that aren't preserved underwater, that aren't preserved anywhere else. And so we have the potential here to learn just incredible things about the people who were here. It just is a time-consuming and expensive process, and you've just got to be able to sort of start working through it. Another thing is nobody's done this here, so we're sort of having to make it up as we go for how we do things and what we're looking at and how to even interpret what we're doing.
What are some of the challenges being in West Africa? It's not like you can go down to your dive shop and get something when it breaks and so on. So what are some of the challenges that you've run into in the months that you've been here with equipment and so on?
That's a funny question. We have a boat that we intended to use for our work, and we did use it for a little while, but it's got two outboards that are far too complicated for working in West Africa, and we ended up not being able to use our boat at all because we couldn't fix the outboards and get the parts for them. So this very expensive boat that we have to do our work, we ended up using a fishing canoe, which worked, and I'm thankful for the option. They're not actually very comfortable. Then again, a lot of our work isn't. So the boat was an issue. We dive, depending on what we're doing, we dive wearing just scuba tanks, and sometimes we dive with surface supplied air. And for a good portion of the time, the surface supplied air wasn't working, so we had to dive with tanks, and that wasn't a big deal because we had a compressor to fill the tanks. But then the compressor went out, so then we had to have the surface supplied air fixed, and some days it worked and some days it didn't. So some days you'd get out to sea and then have no air and couldn't work, so you'd have to come back in, and that'd be the whole day shot. Those were the major things. We also tried, a lot of underwater archaeology is done with small dredges, essentially a vacuum cleaner to excavate things, and getting a design to work, getting the parts for it didn't work, so we ended up excavating with trowels and garden shovels, and pulling the sediment up onto the canoe by hand. So you're pulling 200-pound buckets of sand and dirt on, not dirt, sediment, sand and sediment onto this canoe, and sorting through it, sifting through it on the canoe. So a lot of it, honestly, simpler is better, and people say that as a bit of a cliche, but in this environment it really is. I think one of the neatest things is that we still got anything done, and a lot of that was purely done on people power, and that's something that that you can deal with here. You know, in the U.S. we could have gotten our machines fixed. We did some mechanic stuff ourselves, but a lot of things you just couldn't work with. We worked with a mechanic in town, but in the U.S. the likelihood of finding somebody who's willing to sit on a canoe all day with you and haul 200-pound buckets of sediment to the surface, really, you're just not going to, you know? And people power here is amazing. If we needed our boat moved, you know, we would have people pick up and move canoes to get out of the way so we could put our boat in and out of the water. And it's humbling in that way to be able to see that these people are incredibly poor and to see what they can accomplish with the little bit that they have. And then how we can apply that to our work too, not only when our equipment breaks, but I think it's something that we should take when our equipment works too. Yeah. That was a bit of a morality lesson, sorry.
What do the Ghanaians in El Mina, what do they think of this work that you're doing? Did they know that there were ships or a ship offshore? And what do they think about the idea of you going out there every day to pull that stuff up?
I think we're absolutely crazy. We go to sea every day and don't come back with any fish, and they cannot figure that out. Because El Mina is dominated by the fortress, by the castle, everybody knows that there's a lot of history in El Mina. They call it the ancient town, which is kind of funny because it's not, but in terms of European history, it is ancient here. But there's that constant reminder that somebody else was here, that there was that outside connection, but there's not an understanding of it at all. So for a long time, people just thought we were out here looking for gold, and a lot of people still think that, oh, they're going to take gold from our waters. But a number of people eventually got the courage to ask, which is part of our work, you know, is being able to educate and tell people what we're doing. And that was always neat, because we could explain, no, we're studying history, we're studying people from the past, and we just happen to be studying it underwater, from something that they left underwater, which they don't necessarily have much of a concept of, but they understand that, you know, that there was a lot of interaction in the past, and they get excited about it when we explain what our work is, that we're studying history, and we're looking at the Europeans who came, but then we're also looking at the Ghanaians and how they worked together and how it built El Mina. And it's really easy to talk to the fishermen because you can relate it to sailing and you know, look at all the time they spent on the boats on the water. And that's their world, so they can understand that. They still, most of the time, think we're crazy for not bringing in fish. But some, the people who bother to ask or who have the courage to ask generally get excited. We actually work very, very closely with a number of the fishermen, and we're very connected with one of the fishermen who's really high up in the community. And that's an amazing connection to have, because he can tell people too, and he understands the concept. One bit of anthropology here is the fishermen know Greg Cook, when he came out here, the guy who started this project, spent a lot of time just hanging out with the fishermen and asking them, you know, do you know of anything that's under the sea? And they would all say, oh yeah, there are rocks there that would catch our nets, or here, or whatever. And so when Greg figured out that this was a shipwreck, Papa Kofi, who was one of the fishermen, the high-up fishermen with him, said, oh yes, it's a shiprock. And we call them shipwrecks, but to them, the importance is that there's a rock there that catches their net. And we've said, no, it's a shipwreck. So to him, it's a shipwreck, because that's how you meld those two ideas. Yeah. Is they just know there's something down there. And it's been really neat, actually, to watch Papa Kofi, to watch his understanding, and then watch him sort of disseminate it through that.
You said the project's completed now, so what is kind of the future of the project? Are you planning on coming back? You mentioned coming back to Nigeria and so on. So what are your kind of future plans from here on?
I'm still here for a little while. I've got to clean up, put equipment away, move it, store it, and all that, and do a bunch of assessment, actually, of data that we have while in the field. So the going to sea part is finished, but there's still, you know, there's always logistics on both ends and that sort of thing. I hope to make this sort of a lifetime career, is working in West Africa. It's all very, very dependent on grants, on applying for funding. For a long time, and even sort of now, people view underwater archaeology as sort of the red-headed stepchild of archaeology, of why would you go underwater when you can do it on land and learn the same things? But you really can't. But the disadvantage of that also is archaeology underwater is exponentially more expensive than terrestrial archaeology, and that's actually something I struggle with as a Christian sometimes, is how do I justify working in a field that's so phenomenally expensive to do the same things that in some ways you can do in other places, in some ways not. But even, you know, working in this community where, you know, our equipment costs more than many of these people will see in their entire lives. And how do we justify bringing that in? And you can look at the economics. This is actually something in ethics and archaeology of, you know, what do you give back to the community? And we employ a lot of people, and there's a lot of connection that way. But that's something that all of that has to go into how you apply for grants, how you phrase it, how you work with it. A lot of granting agencies are looking more at, well, what do you give to the community? And that's something, I think, that's a very, very good question for archaeologists to ask. It's something that we have to, but it hasn't always been asked. So that's not preaching, but that's saying all of these things have to go into how do I justify working out here? How do I justify getting the money to do it? And then what do I do with that? What do I do with that in return in terms of giving back to these people? And education is a huge part of it. But that's something that I hope to do over time, to work both in Ghana and Nigeria, maybe in between in Togo and Benin as well. But that's really, really long term. And right now we're just, you know, we've worked on one shipwreck. It's really just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, hey, thanks for talking with me. I met you last night and I thought, hey, this will be fascinating to talk to you. And I saw some of your photos, so I'm going to add some of the photos to the blog. I think you've educated anyone who listens to this about marine archaeology, because I didn't know anything about it before, so thanks a lot.